Today in Studio 360, when the comedian Michael Ian Black wrote his frank and pretty intimate memoir, he gave his wife veto power. Her one objection?
She was furious. She's like, I would never order a banana and Nutella crepe. That's what children order. You ordered the banana and Nutella crepe.
Michael Ian Black's new book is both sweet and savory. And then...
I think of this as a tune perhaps named after a gang of pals who like to maybe go out for a drink to the pub or like to work together or carouse together.
The record that introduced Celtic music to the rest of the world.
The Irish come from an oppressed background during which their language was forbidden to be spoken in public. So their most powerful means of expression left to them was the music.
That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC, right after this. But first, Jerry Lewis is best known for his goofy, broad film comedies from the 1950s and 60s, like The Nutty Professor.
Carbon dioxide has always been a gas. No, I didn't mean, yes, actually it kind of swings and...
But in the early 70s, Jerry Lewis decided to take a very serious turn. He starred in and directed a movie called The Day the Clown Cried. In it, Lewis plays a circus clown in Nazi Germany who entertains the children in a concentration camp as they're about to be murdered. The movie was never released, which may have been for the best, since lots of people say that it is the worst film ever made. Lewis has just donated his entire film archive to the Library of Congress, including a copy of The Day the Clown Cried. But he insisted that it not be shown to anybody for at least 10 years. So for now, only a handful of people have actually seen it, and one of them is my guest, the actor, writer, and radio host Harry Shearer, who's probably best known as the voice of Montgomery Burns and Ned Flanders and lots of other characters on The Simpsons. Harry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kurt.
So this, according to Jerry's instructions, can't be seen for 10 years when, if he is still living, he'll be 99. What's that about, do you suppose?
There were years when Jerry Lewis didn't say anything publicly about it. But, you know, in recent years, Jerry Lewis has been very forthright himself in saying it was awful. It was a bad movie. That's why he doesn't want people to see it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you can't blame a person for saying, yeah, I hate this piece of work. I don't want to be around when people see it.
Yep.
So,
yep.
It was bad, bad, bad. It could have been wonderful. But I slipped up.
That was Jerry Lewis in a recent BBC documentary about The Day the Clown Cried. Now, I probably, unlike perhaps Jerry Lewis, will live another 10 years, so I'll get to see it.
Now, you are a lucky man. Well, take your vitamins is all I can say. Do your yoga.
The synopsis of the film just sounds impossibly bad.
Yeah.
Is it beyond that synopsis? Is that fair, or is there more to the story?
I think it's worse than you would be led to believe just by the force of your own imagination. I think that's the power at work here. It was described to me before I saw it, and it exceeded my expectations in that regard.
How did you get to see it? Because it was never actually properly finished or released.
No, I saw a rough cut of it, which was made available for me to see on a very limited basis by somebody who had access to it for a very limited period of time.
It was Gary Lewis, wasn't it?
It was not. No, I'm not going to go down the list with you. It was none of Jerry's sons, let's put it that way.
And this was when that you saw it?
This was, let's see, in the mid to late 70s.
Uh-huh. So it was new still.
It was fresh in that very particular sense of the word. In chronologically speaking, it was fresh.
And even though it was so traumatizing that you don't remember very many specific moments, were there?
Don't feel sorry for me.
Were there? I mean, was it?
I didn't need therapy afterwards.
Was it just the notion of Jerry Lewis being a clown?
No. It was the actual treatment of it. It was the actual
lines and the jokes and the
ham-handedness. There were very few jokes. It was. I just remember the overall feeling of it, which was it couldn't be more wrong.
Yeah. What was going through his mind as he thought, okay, I've read this script and I can make I can do this. What do you think he was thinking?
You have to remember, Jerry Lewis is the author of a book called The Total Filmmaker. He had an extremely high opinion of himself as a filmmaker, as a director, as an auteur. This was encouraged at the time by the French. I think still doing that.
Who regard him as a great filmmaker?
Yeah.
Then I wound up getting 8 Best Director of the Year awards in Europe, 1 here in England.
Your own people don't estimate you, haven't really given you the kind of accolades that perhaps you deserve and that the French have given you.
Well, the Americans have no taste. We know that.
So he had no reason in the world of Jerry Lewis to believe that he couldn't do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it comes as no surprise that, like a lot of people in other circumstances, say certain people running for president or certain people occupying the White House, there don't seem to be a sufficient number of people around him to say the crucial words, "Are you out of your mind, sir?"
Yes. Yeah. Harry Shearer, it is always a pleasure. We'll talk again, and thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, Kurt. Always a pleasure.
Harry Shearer is the host of the public radio program and podcast Le Show, and stars as Richard Nixon in the series Nixon's the One. Do you do Jerry Lewis? Is he one of your voices?
I mean, you know, if I'm awakened in the middle of a deep sleep in the middle of the night and somebody says, "Do Hey Lady or We Kill You," I'll do a Hey Lady.
By the way, if you'd like to find out even more about The Day the Clown Cried, 24 years ago, when I was editing Spy Magazine, we published an oral history of the film called Jerry Goes to Death Camp. And you can find a link to that piece at studio360.org. Of course, it's not always a fiasco when comedians try to do more serious work. Michael Ian Black has been all over television for decades, being funny. But these days, he's writing books as well. And while the books are funny, they're also full of complicated true stories and ideas and real sentiment. Black was only 22 when he starred as a founding member of the MTV sketch comedy show The State. Today, he's both in the Wet Hot American Summer sequel on Netflix and the Jim Gaffigan show on TV Land.
Jim, have you lost weight?
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. I am a little worried about Jeannie.
Why?
She was with me in college. Now she's with you. Is there a history of mental illness in her family?
No, I think she just decided she didn't want to be with a snide, nasty bitch.
And he does stand-up comedy and hosts multiple podcasts. He just published his second memoir called Navel Gazing, True Tales of Bodies, Mostly Mine, and then in parentheses, but also My Mom's, which I know sounds weird. Michael Ian Black, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Maybe we'll begin and get in the mood by having you read a bit from this book.
All right. I will select the passage that you selected for me. I feel bad about my feet. Here are some other things I feel bad about. The almost 1-to-1 ratio of the diameter of my upper arms to my wrists, the red blob on my chest, which I am told is a harmless blood vessel, but which reads to the untrained eye like a little clown nose, the fact that my mustache grows at a much quicker rate than my beard so that I have the perpetual look of a 13-year-old Mexican boy, the fact that my right shoulder rests higher than my left, no matter how many times throughout the day I attempt to rearrange my spine, my height, which is 2 inches less than optimal, the curvature of my nose, which is approaching Owen Wilson levels of unsightliness, my drooping scrotum, which by the year is slowly sinking into the earth like the city of Venice, the mysterious red slashes I discover on my shoulders and back each morning, the result of sleep scratching, which, after researching, I discover is an actual mental disorder I seem to have, as is my trichotillomania, the compulsive desire to pull out hair, in my case, beard whiskers, resulting in a large bare patch under my right jawline where there should be beard, which does nothing to diminish my 13-year-old Mexican boy look. I feel bad about my escalating weight and the amount of arm hair I have, as well as my armpit hair, which extends farther down the underside of my arm than I think it ought to, and also the shade of my skin, which is the Crayola color between pallid and jaundiced. This is only a partial list.
That is Michael Ian Black reading from Navel Gazing. I laughed out loud at least once, maybe twice, when I first read that. And, of course, because I shared many of your...
many of my shames.
Many of your shames. Yeah, exactly. You've written about your wife in two books now. Does she get some kind of veto power?
When I wrote the last book, I said, I'm going to write this book, a lot of which will be about our marriage. And she said, I will have veto authority over that. And I said, no, you will not. And she said, yes, I will. And she did. Now, the only thing she ended up objecting to really in the last book was I told the story about us going on our honeymoon to Amsterdam. And we discovered this little pancake place. And in the book I wrote that she ordered a banana and Nutella crepe and I ordered a ham and cheese crepe. And she was furious. She's like, I would never order a banana and Nutella crepe. That's what children order. You ordered the banana and Nutella crepe. And I'm like, if that's the biggest objection you have, I think we're going to be okay.
Wow. You write about how your mother and her lesbian partner tried to out you as gay when you were, I guess, like 14. It sounds
yeah,
like.
Around there, 13, 14.
Then you learn later that her parents had handled it badly when they found out she was gay, and she was super committed to that not happening to you.
I think that was part of it. She convinced herself that I was gay, and right. There were certainly signs that I might have been. I mean, I had declared that I was going to be an actor at the age right. of 9, and as I say in the book, that is not a population known for its robust heterosexual
yeah.
grouping. And the only thing I knew about myself at that point in my life was that I was straight.
Yes.
I mean, I knew that.
Which you very graphically depict.
Yes, I do. Because I at that point in my life, had started some explorations with a neighborhood girl. But I couldn't tell her that. And so they sat me down, she and her partner, they sat me down and they basically said, look, it's okay. You know, being gay is totally natural and normal. And I was confused because I thought they were talking about themselves and like I had offended them in some way. But it turns out they were talking about me and they were outing me.
It sounds like an episode of a sitcom.
It does. It didn't feel that way.
Of that.
It felt like such an intrusion and such an overreach. On their part.
So then, ironically, in your first big movie role in What Hot American Summer, you play a gay character.
Well, that's the thing. I'm only cast as gay guys even up until this point. I'm on a show right now where I play a gay guy, yeah. The Jim Gaffigan show.
Yeah. You've got two kids. And 3 years ago, I heard you give an absolutely great stand-up performance in which you used your daughter in the act. And she was 9, maybe?
Yeah.
What's your daughter's name?
Ruthie.
Ruthie is a great sport. She's the straight person kind of in this act. How did you get the idea?
I thought it would be fun because my kids had never seen me do stand-up to that point.
Really?
To bring, well, I say filthy things.
Yeah.
And to bring my daughter on stage with me and have her sit on a stool during the performance and I would do my act. And just see what happened. And it was funny. It was funny to see her react.
It was really funny. And you made a thing of how dirty am I going to be. And, it was good. I want to play a clip of that performance that aired on Bullseye.
As a parent, I couldn't wait to see what they would be for Halloween because kids have amazing imaginations. They could be anything. Couldn't wait. This is what my kids decided to be. My son decided to go as a pirate. My daughter decided to go as a princess. No, don't patronize her. The least creative costumes in the world. The most hackneyed, just with a little more effort, they could have been amazing costumes. You know, if my son had been like, I want to be a pirate, I want to be a Somali pirate, I would have been like, good costume. If my daughter had been like, I want to be a princess, I want to be a Jewish-American princess. Good costume.
How did she feel about it afterwards? Was it, Daddy, I don't ever want to do that again, or was it fun?
I think she was delighted with the reaction to her.
So she got it?
She definitely got it. She definitely understood that she had been the star attraction, and I let her know that she'd been the star attraction. Thankfully, that did not result in her the next day going, Dad, I really think I want to be a comedian.
You know what the kid next door went as? A cat's tail. You understand? Not a cat. Cat's tail. When he came to our house and explained to me that he was not, in fact, a pipe cleaner... which also would have been excellent, but was a cat's tail, I did not give that child candy. I gave him a hug, and I wrote him a check for $100.
So a lot of this book is, as we've said, about mortality and aging. Is that a subject or a subject for you that works better in this essayistic form than it does as a part of the stand-up act?
Yeah. It's interesting. I feel like I have almost two different voices, one that I use for stand-up, one that I use for books, and I'm trying to merge them, and it's hard. It's very hard to do because stand-up, by necessity, demands a kind of joke every few moments.
Right.
And I've been trying to kind of inject more literary moments into my stand-up, and it doesn't go over very well at all. People don't respond to it at all. But I feel like that's kind of more who I am.
And when you came to college at NYU, the intention was to become a dramatic actor, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, I never had any intention of ending up in comedy. I liked comedy.
Not the class clown kind of person?
No, not at all. Yeah. No, I was fairly quiet. I think I made my friends laugh to a certain extent, but I just never envisioned that for myself. I thought I would be doing regional theater my entire career, doing the classics, you know, sort of being a vagabond, being very poor. I mean, going around and doing regional theater to me was like, as I said, the heterosexual population in theater is not very robust. So I thought I would do very well for myself.
You have recently launched a podcast called How to Be Amazing, where you talk to people, not unlike this, whom you admire. You ask them for the worst and best pieces of advice they ever got.
Mm-hmm.
What are yours?
Best advice I ever got, professionally, not personally. Personally, this is actually bad advice. Professionally, the best advice I ever got was, you're not on time unless you're 10 minutes early. That has been excellent advice throughout my life. Personally, that's terrible advice. Don't show up at a 7 o'clock party at 6:50. Yes. Show up at a 7 o'clock party at 8:15. The worst advice, that's always the hard one. Well, it's probably the one that a lot of people who are going into the arts get, which is you really need to have a backup. You really need to, you know, get the teaching degree or whatever it is. And I've heard other people talk about this, how if you give yourself the out, you'll take the out.
Uh-huh.
And I was very cognizant of that. Like you know, my mom was like hell bent on me getting some kind of vocational career that I could fall back on. And I was like, no, there's just no chance I'm going to do that because that's what I'll end up doing. I don't want to be a substitute teacher. I don't want to teach theater at high school. I want to be an actor.
But of course, most people aren't as successful as you and they're going to end up without a fallback and be in some bad place.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, in my experience, the adults that I grew up with in New York, meaning like when I moved to New York and the adults that I met who were pursuing careers in this field and were doing it doggedly and didn't give up, most of those people have careers in the arts doing what they want to do.
Me too. Calling your show How to Be Amazing, people are going to tend to say, let me sign up.
Oh, yeah. It's a very pandery
title. Yes, exactly. So now that you're in this racket, how was this interview?
1 to 10. On your end, 9. My response is 6.5, 7.
Well, all I care about is myself. So thank you very much, Mike Liam Black.
Thank you, Kurt.
Groovy.
Mike Liam Black's new book, Navel Gazing, is just out, and you can hear him read a full chapter from it at studio360.org. It's never easy to ignore critics, but it's really hard for the fiction writer George Saunders when the story he's writing seems to attack him.
You're being very confident, you're a skilled professional, and then the story says, no, that's in the next room over for boring people.
Coming up, what makes a short story great? That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
love you. I love you. I love you, you. I love you.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Valentine's Day is all about feelings. Sweet feelings, romantic feelings, or the kind of feelings you bury in a pint of chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream. Studio 360 wants you to express those feelings, and we want them in the form of a GIF. Those very short, looping animations that are now unavoidable on the internet. Your GIF can be joyful or sad, earnest, sardonic, addressed to your sweetheart or your barista or your Wheaton Terrier. Pretty much anything goes as long as it's shorter than 10 seconds and it loops. We're calling this challenge My Giphy Valentine. It's a collaboration with Giphy.com, and we've got not one, but two guest judges for this challenge. The hosts of the very smart, very funny BuzzFeed podcast, Another Round, Heaven Nagatu and Tracy Clayton. Heaven and Tracy, welcome to Studio 360.
Hey. Thank you very much for having us.
So let's start with the absolute most basic question. Tell everybody what a GIF is.
Firstly, it's pronounced GIF.
Oh, God. Here we go.
And this, of course, listeners, is an ongoing debate, a theological debate among GIFies about how to pronounce it. But anyway, the GIF.
So the GIF, thank you very much for that, is basically just a very short clip of some piece of video. It could be from a television show or a movie. It could be something that somebody organically makes themselves if they have such skills. But they're most commonly used on the internet to convey different feelings and emotions and reactions.
And there we go. So, Heaven, what, in your view, makes for a great top-notch GIF?
A good GIF is something that like conveys something you couldn't otherwise express with your words online, which is a lot of things. Like a lot of human communication is body language or what have you. So GIFs convey that. But also the good ones are like they loop, they catch a moment, or they magnify something that was otherwise uninteresting.
Right. They make me nervous a little bit. Just the sheer repetition kind of doesn't jibe well with my brain. You don't have that problem, I guess, neither of you. You just like seeing this weird little 10-second repetition.
Yeah. It's like when you get like a really good bite of food, you're not like, oh, that was satisfying. Like you want another bite, and you just want to keep doing it over and over again until either you get full of watching it or eating it or whatever.
Okay. Well, maybe this whole thing will persuade me. Well, let's talk about this challenge that we're doing. The idea is to replace the traditional Valentine with a digital version, a GIF Valentine. Is there anything that you think people should keep in mind as they're working on their GIF Valentine entries?
Be original. Be creative. You need to like challenge yourself a little bit. You can, if you're good at Photoshop and animation, you can do that. If you have like a camera on your phone, which most people do, you can make a video that way and make a GIF of it.
Even pop culture wise, don't feel like you have to go with like the most relatable. I don't know. I'm so tired of Jennifer Lawrence GIFs. We get it. She's relatable. Relatable feelings. We get it. Try something new.
Right.
So these Valentines don't have to be just for romantic situations. You could make one for your mom or just to let her know you're thinking about her. Who else should people think about giving Valentines to other than the obvious boyfriend, girlfriend?
Me. Just send me all your Valentines. Also, maybe the mailman. He goes through a lot. I don't know. It's cold outside right now. Give him a Valentine.
So if some special someone were going to make a gift Valentine for you, what would you want it to be, Heaven?
Anything that says we are tiny specks of dust on this earth, but I like spending time with you, other speck of dust. An existential Valentine for me. Tracy, what kind of Valentine would you want?
I am partial to many things.
Okay.
With me, you can basically never go wrong with a good penguin GIF.
Ooh.
They're so goofy. They just waddle around looking a mess.
True.
And sometimes they just fall for no reason.
They're like a walking GIF.
Yes. Oh my gosh. So penguins work. Also, any GIFs of Jason Momoa would make my heart very happy.
Ooh.
Yes. If you can get both those things in one GIF, I will marry you.
That's a beautiful Valentine.
I know, right?
Tracy and Heaven, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having us.
And you'll be back
We'll be back.
After you get glutted with all these entries.
Yes.
So, people, now you're ready, I hope, to make a GIF or a GIF Valentine for somebody you love or somebody you like a little or, I don't know, somebody who lent you $10. You can get all the details, including instructions for how to make a GIF, at studio360.org/GIF. That's GIF. So 10-second GIFs and 140-character tweets are now the new normal. But shortness is a relative notion. When it comes to fiction, stories that are thousands of words long, 25,000 characters long, are still considered short stories. One of their chief devotees is my pal Sarah Montague. She produces a radio show and podcast called Selected Shorts, where short fiction gets its close-up. Name brand actors read them out loud to rapt live audiences. But Selected Shorts doesn't often feature the voices of short fiction writers themselves. So Sarah decided to talk to some of the best around to see how it's going for them. She started with a favorite of mine who edited one of the two new short story anthologies that are just out, Laurie Moore.
You may be lying there quietly resting in the International House of Literature and hear something in the walls, the click and burst of heat through pipes, a difficult settling of eaves, ice sliding off the roof, the scurry of animals, the squawk of a floorboard, someone coming up the stairs.
That's Laurie Moore reading from her introduction to 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories. It perfectly captures the stealthy charm of short fiction. Moore says that assembling the anthology made her feel she was looking at history. The story is what generations of writers called home.
I think of them as like little houses that writers go in and redecorate. Maybe sort of add a room, put different curtains up, put different furniture, different people in it, and then they clear out and someone else moves in.
Heidi Pittler is the series editor for Best American Short Stories and has the long view on how writers furnished the form.
There was a huge amount of stories that were very formulaic. They involved happy characters, detectives, salesmen, and they always, you know, wrapped things up in a very happy ending.
Pittler says the Best American anthology was looking for something different when it debuted in 1915. Something
messier and more reflective of real life. Writers were starting to feel the same way, too. They wanted to feel freer in their stories, to give primacy to character or voice or emotion or style.
One example is Sherwood Anderson's 1921 story, Brothers, which Jane Kaczmarek read at a recent Selected Shorts event.
Yesterday morning, I woke at daybreak and I went for a walk. There was a heavy fog and I lost myself in it. I went down to the plains and returned to the hills, and everywhere the fog was as a wall before me. Out of it, trees sprang suddenly, grotesquely. As in a city street late at night, people come suddenly out of the darkness into the circle of light under a street lamp.
Sherwood Anderson has to be the most influential writer out there. Just his use of the daily vernacular. It's really exciting to say, wow, you're almost reading a family tree here.
Women slowly became part of that mix, like the Southern writer Flannery O'Connor, who described domestic life with a dark, sardonic wit. Her great story, Everything That Rises Must Converge, shows us the tense relationship between a shabby, genteel mother and her petulant son.
She was almost ready to go, standing before the hall mirror, putting on her hat, while he, his hands behind him, appeared pinned to the door frame, waiting like Saint Sebastian for the arrows to begin piercing him. The hat was new and had cost her $7.50. She kept saying, "Maybe I shouldn't have paid that for it. No, I shouldn't have. I'll take it off and return it tomorrow. I shouldn't have bought it." Julian raised his eyes to heaven. "Yes, you should have bought it," he said. "Put it on and let's go." It was a hideous hat.
Estelle Parsons read O'Connor's story. It was one of many stories that shaped Southern writing, a new territory. As the century progressed, there were other changes, too. Here's Heidi Pittler.
The last part of the book is filled with a bunch of stories that are far more diverse, both in terms of voice, but in terms of content, character, experience, economics, place.
These new voices were enabled by a new market, the MFA program. As print magazines declined, college programs expanded. In the 1980s, there were just a handful. Now there are thousands. Detractors say they produce cookie-cutter fiction and are prone to a certain preciousness. A Twitter persona called Guy in Your MFA has 64,000 followers.
I didn't really feel like any of your characters were complex, you know? I related to Holden Caulfield on a level you wouldn't understand. Your protagonist didn't drink whiskey even once. Sometimes it feels like my darlings are killing me.
But writing is, after all, a craft.
Think about it almost like there's been a proliferation of great carpentry schools that have opened up all over the country.
Hannah Tinty is a fiction writer and the editor of One Story magazine.
And now when you walk around, there are a lot of really well-made tables. And then every once in a while, you see one that's an artisanal table that's extraordinary, made out of a really unique piece of wood with carvings, you know, that you look at and you're like, only that singular person could have made that table.
Because stories aren't just a craft, they're an art. George Saunders is the author of the best-selling collection The 10th of December and the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award.
Almost every story has that dynamic where you start off with something. You become increasingly fond of that something. You start to see what your story is about. You're being very confident. You're a skilled professional. And then the story says, no, 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 no. That's in the next room over for boring people. In this room, you have to continue to thrill me to the end, which means you have to take whatever you've created and start interrogating it and messing with it.
And that's what the Best American Anthology and Ben Marcus's New American Fiction celebrate.
I wanted to maybe have my face rubbed in what mattered and what's important and what people are afraid of. There's, to me, a deep and bottomless entertainment in a kind of fiction that does not look away from some fairly basic truths about what it is to be a person in the world.
One of Marcus's picks for the New American Fiction Anthology was 80-year-old Robert Coover's Going for a Beer. It's read here by the late Isaiah Sheffer.
He finds himself sitting in the neighborhood bar drinking a beer at about the same time that he began to think about going there for one. In fact, he has finished it. Perhaps he'll have a second one, he thinks, as he downs it and asks for a third. There's a young woman sitting not far from him who's not exactly good-looking, but good-looking enough, and probably good in bed, as indeed she is. Did he finish his beer? Can't remember.
It seems almost light and comedic, and yet, by the end, we're entirely undone. There's something sort of devastating that's been achieved. I'm very attracted to stories that, even though they seem perhaps to be more strictly comic, are slowly doing deeper work.
George Saunders thinks this is what happens when a sophisticated form returns to its roots.
Seems like the direction the story is going is almost a reversion back to the stories that were told in caves.
Even if the cave is now an iPhone. More people are doing that reading on their phones and their tablets, inspiring lower word counts and more flash fiction, says Hannah Tinty. But still, we need stories as much, if not more, than we ever did.
I think there's something unique about reading a short story that you can sit down and in 10 or 15 minutes have a complete artistic experience. It can completely transform your life, really. And it's all about creating those elusive moments of deep connection between the writer, the artistic creator, and their reader that sort of transcends time and creates a moment of knowing.
In George Saunders' The Semplicher Girl Diaries, a middle-class family struggles to keep up with the Joneses. But the story tips into the surreal when they install garden sculptures made from the living bodies of migrant girls.
I think Freud said that the story is a dream, but with discipline.
Saunders says that the story started with a dream and was 14 years in the making. Towards the middle, the baffled dad and diarist asks a question to which the short story itself may be the answer.
Someday, I'm sure, dreams will come true. But when? Why not now? Why not?
That was Michael Cerveris reading from The Semplica Girl Diaries by George Saunders. And Sarah Montague is the producer of the radio show and podcast Selected Shorts. Still ahead this hour, back in the 1920s, if you wanted to hear Irish music, you pretty much had to go to Ireland or else know somebody right off the boat. Until a little record called The Boys of the Loch.
Once you partnered up these early recordings with another innovation of the era, which was radio, you had the music coming back to its home again and reinvigorating and indeed saving the music back in its homeland.
How one fiddler from County Sligo put Celtic music on the world map. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Michael Coleman played a mean fiddle. His recordings from the early 1920s set the standard for traditional Irish music. He emigrated to New York from County Sligo in northwest Ireland in 1914. That was also when the recording industry was just getting started. Coleman's The Boys of the Loch was one of the very first Irish songs to be recorded anywhere. To tell the story, we've got the descendant.
My name is Jim O'Byrne. My mother was Mary Coleman. That was her maiden name. And Michael Coleman was my maternal great uncle. He was my grandfather's brother.
The disciple.
My name is Brian Conway. I was born and raised in the Bronx, and I studied fiddle from Martin Wynn, who was a Sligo-style fiddle player.
And the DJ.
My name is Fiona Ritchie. I record and produce a radio program each week for National Public Radio stations called The Thistle and Shamrock. Much of this music is dance music. It's intended for people to dance to, so it has to stick to a particular rhythm and it has to make you want to dance.
Set dancing, where people would get together and they would dance, and it would be not all that different from American square dancing. Or you'd have step dancing, where you'd have people either dancing in groups or individually.
It's the music of the people, of the fireside, of the crossroads, of the bog.
I think of this as a tune perhaps named after a gang of pals who like to maybe go out for a drink to the pub or like to work together or carouse together. In The Boys of the Loch, we're thinking of the landscape of Ireland. And of course, there are many lochs in Ireland. These are just large bodies of water that you would call a lake. The Boys of the Lake. So if someone was to ask me who Michael Coleman was, well, I would say, well, first and foremost, he's a Sligo fiddler.
Sligo is a fairly small county on the northwest of Ireland. It is the home of some great poets. William Butler Yeats was from there.
The Sligo style is upbeat. It's very rhythmic. Uses a lot of ornamentation.
The fiddlers have a particularly ornamented style of playing. They use all kinds of decorative techniques in their playing, so triplets and other decorations.
Okay, so he would start The Boys of the Loch, for instance. That's a bow triplet you're hearing. And the next time he might play that same passage with a roll. So if you look at the sheet music, the music is not played as it's written on sheet music. It's a aspect of the music that drives people who play classical music, for instance, crazy when they try to play Irish music. And that you can't, when you had no way of recording it, the only way to memorialize it was to put it on sheet music, and then it loses that sense of rhythm that can only be captured by hearing it.
For the first time, once Michael Coleman recorded, this was really a turning point for Celtic music and Irish music, because music could travel out from the communities where it had just been a natural, unremarkable part of life. And so once you partnered up these early recordings with another innovation of the era, which was radio, you had the music coming back to its home again and reinvigorating and indeed saving the music, it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say, back in its homeland, because so many of these Communities had been depleted with young folks going away and taking their music with them.
While it's uplifting and happy, there's something sad about the music that just is below the surface.
The Irish come from an oppressed background during which their language was forbidden to be spoken in public. So their most powerful means of expression left to them was the music.
Michael Coleman's influence on traditional Irish music could be compared to Miles Davis and jazz, the Beatles and rock and roll, and his influence is still felt today by those who may never have yet actually listened to Coleman play, but just through what they've learned from other people.
If you look at the long arc of Irish traditional music in the 20th century, you can start with Michael Coleman, and you might find at the other end the Chieftains.
A couple of Irish musicians of his time actually were more savvy than Michael Coleman was. Patsy Tuohy, for instance, a great Uilleann piper who played in groups and played in vaudeville and shows. He actually ended up having a nice life playing music and ended up making a lot of money. The same could not be said for Michael Coleman, who probably died close to destitute when he was in his mid-50s.
So what we're hearing is an excellent fiddler from a part of Ireland famed for fiddling, County Sligo, with an especially expressive playing style, a recording pioneer captured at the height of his powers in the early days of the recording era. What could be better than that?
That was Fiona Ritchie, Brian Conway, and Jim O'Byrne talking about the Irish fiddler Michael Coleman. His album, The Boys of the Loch, was recently inducted into the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress. And at Studio360.org, you can listen to all of the great stories in that series. Stories about Donna Summer and Ornette Coleman and Mel Brooks and many more. The Library of Congress preserves important old music, but there's a songwriter working today who's dreaming up songs that sound like they could have been composed by candlelight a century ago. Joan Shelley has produced an entire album of songs that don't sound quote-unquote retro, but do somehow feel like they're beaming in from the time before digital everything took over our lives. The album is called Over and Even, and it is lovely. Sublime, even. And Joan Shelley is here with her guitarist, Nathan Salzberg, to play songs from it and talk. Welcome.
Thank you.
Will you play a song?
Sure.
And what will it be?
This is one called Stay on My Shore. Thank you.
sweet and our skin with the salt and the stone. Lace the pages of our story.
That was Nathan Salzberg playing guitar and Joan Shelley on guitar and singing her tune Stay on My Shore. So that one that you just played has lyrics about sailing and feeding birds and chopping wood. How pre-modern and wholesome your subject matter is.
Those symbols stand out to me a little more than texting while walking and on the sidewalk and stuff like that.
You're just not interested in the detritus of everyday modern life, I guess.
Right. I think it's something I go to try to create uncluttered worlds. So why would I just bring my clutter?
Yeah. Although plenty of writers bring their clutter and that works for them.
They do.
You grew up outside Louisville, Kentucky, where you still live. Has that area, that part of the world and the culture influenced the music you do?
Yeah. It's where I draw the images from a lot of times. And it's hard to say how to pick that stuff out, I think. You know, I'm in it.
Yeah.
I can't, and I've never gone and lived somewhere else enough to know what it looks like from the outside, feels like somewhere else.
What is it about home that seems to generate songs for you? As opposed to busted love affairs or something more dramatic.
Dramatic, and I think a little bit overplayed, I think, you know, the end of the bottle stuff. I mean, I love old-time country, and I love a lot of the themes that come up in pop and country and rock, but it's not my experience, so I won't pretend, you know?
So until you have a terrible country life, you won't sing about it.
Exactly.
Good. Well, that no doubt will happen sooner or later in some small measure. And the songs do sound to me like songs I listened to as a kid in the late 60s and 70s, like, you know, Joni and Judy and all those people. Were those albums you listened to growing up?
No. I listened to a lot of, like, oldies stations and just recorded little tapes on my funny little Sony kids player. and then, like, classic rock. I just liked pop, kind of, as a kid, and a lot of world music that my mom had. I wasn't really one of those who had like an identity based on music. I didn't like go to certain kind of scenes.
You were just like a kid listening to music, like a lot of us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point did you really decide, wow, this is what I want to do and this will be my profession or my calling or my vocation?
I didn't really think that it was possible. I don't even know now if it is, but it wasn't until maybe 4 years ago when I met this other group of ladies in Louisville who were, we made some records. I started enjoying making records so much that I just wanted to figure out a way to keep doing it.
Well, will you play us out with one more song?
Sure.
And this will be?
Not Over by Half.
Joan Shelley's new album is called Over and Even, and it is out right now.
You've torn your shirt, you've outgrown this town. Your friends are all scattered and you're lonesome. But you're still searching for music in the sounds. It's a tame world would leave you unbroken. Lady, oh mother, bring your garden to me. Pull it round my body so the world cannot see. Blue of my veins and the tracks on my cheeks. Leave the tulips for when I.
That's it for this week's show. Thank you very, very much for listening. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Danielle Fox, Afi
Yelody, Kate Essig,
Zakia Gibbons.
And our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
When that day comes and the lights go dim, the weight off your shoulders, the sun off your skin, and the ones who have known you.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Steve Martin's album Wild and Crazy Guy proved that smart comedy was not too smart for the American room.
He could have won a Grammy, buried in his jammies.
America's groundbreaking cerebral goofball, that's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.